It's here.
Can you hear me?
Marissa, you would say hello? Okay, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Claudia Diaz. I'm Associate Director here at the Great Lakes ADA Center. I wanted to welcome everyone to the WebED Professional Development and ADA National Network Legal Webinar Series. This is a special session that we're joined today with our sister office, the Southwest ADA Center. Today's session, we'll have a couple of things that I want to go over before we get started today's session. I just wanted to talk about the Luminate platform. I'd like to make everyone aware that we have closed captioning running at this time. So if you have a group, you can click on the CC icon found at the top, and that will open a captioning window that you can drag around and expand or collapse to your preference. I also wanted to make everyone aware that there is keyboard command of control F8 to access the captioning and control W to close that. The Luminate platform allows for you to submit questions. We are making those private at this time, so in the chat area you can put in your question. The moderator will see those throughout the session. We have designated a question and answer segment, and the presenter and moderator will address those questions at this time. To access the chat area via keyboard function, that would be Control M. And one last thing I'd like to ask everyone is to refrain from playing with the emotion icons. That's a little bit distracting. The hand raising that becomes blinking, so forth. So if you can just refrain from using those, I would appreciate it. At this time, I'd like to pass it over to Marissa DeMaio from our sister office, Southwest ADA Center. You have the floor, Marissa.
Thanks, Claudia. Hi, everyone. This is Marissa DeMaio with the Southwest ADA Center, and I will be serving as moderator for today's session. Today's program is brought to you as a collaborative effort between the Great Lakes and Southwest ADA Centers and the Resna Catalyst Project. For those tuning in today, if you did not download a copy of today's PowerPoint presentation prior to the session, you will be able to have access to that in the archive section of the website at www.adaconferences.org/resna, and that'll be available after the conclusion of today's program. And of course, this session is being recorded, so the recording will be available probably within about 24 hours of the conclusion of today's session. Our presenter will provide us with some valuable information today, and of course, at the conclusion of his presentation, there will be an opportunity for everyone to ask their questions, as Claudia mentioned. So just a quick reminder that you can submit your questions there using the chat area. Let me begin today's session by introducing Tally Wells, attorney and director of the Mental Health and Disability Rights Project at the Atlanta Legal Aid Society. For a bit more information about Tally and the great work that he's done, please take a look at his bio. It is posted on the www.adaconferences.org/resna website. And now I'm going to go ahead and turn the program over to Tally. Tally?
Great, thank you. I am very excited to be presenting today on Homestead Planning. The title is Homestead Planning, Litigant and Improving Community Services. If you've seen a title that's similar but not exactly the same, it's because this presentation has been a beautiful work have. It has evolved as we've been in conversation in preparation for today's session. I am particularly interested in talking about Homestead and being in conversation with you about Homestead Planning because it is one of the most important aspects of this decision in Homestead, and we'll get into the Homestead decision for those of you who are less familiar with it. But Homestead Planning was a big part of it at the time. There's never been a real clear definition as to what Homestead Planning is. And if you look at the 50 states as laboratories for Homestead Planning, first of all, you'll see that almost no states have actually come up with a real solid way of putting together an Olmstead plan. That planning and making the decisions about how the state is going to truly enable people with disabilities to live in the community rather than institutions is one of the most important civil rights movements that's going on today. It, of course, has tremendous for the people who are going through it. And it is fundamentally changing all of our states. And so it's a critical of us need to be engaging in more and more. And states will have less and less and less excuses for not doing Olmstead planning. Let's get into it. I'm really excited to talk about this, and we'll talk about what rights individuals have receiving state-funded services to live in the most integrated setting and to receive supports in the most integrated setting. We'll briefly describe what it is. Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. We're getting crackling or a static on your line. I hate to do this, but can you hang up and call back in and see if that clears up?
Sure.
I apologize, everyone. Just that there's this constant crackling going on while he's speaking, and we like to clear that up so we can be able to appreciate your presentation.
Thanks, Claudia. We'll stand by for just a second while Tally rejoins us.
This is Tally Wells again. How's that?
Try it again, a little bit longer so you can hear that.
Okay, this is Tally Wells, and I am speaking in the presentation.
Yeah, people are saying it's still the same. So I don't think it's going
to
change.
Let me try to change one thing about my handset. I apologize to everyone. We checked ahead of time, but let me just play with one thing.
Yeah, thank you, everyone, and we apologize for this little technical glitch, but if we can get the sound better, that would make the presentation much more smooth, and we would be able to appreciate everything, information we're receiving much better. And thank you, everyone, for bearing with us. This often happens when we're trying to broadcast sound through the Internet. Sometimes we get good Internet connections, and sometimes we don't, and hopefully we can get this a good connection. If not, I'll ask everyone to bear with us.
All right, this is Tally Wells in testing.
Okay, welcome back, Tally. I think the sound is still there, so it has to be the internet connection or some other technical issue. So. I'll just have to ask everyone to bear with us, and if you can speak slowly, that will help, and go ahead with your presentation.
Great. You'll also discuss some of the community supports that have both resulted from the Olmstead decision, but also those supports that are really to carry out the mandate that is part of the Olmstead decision. And we'll also identify some assistive technology that could be used to provide quality community supports for people returning to the community from institutions. Many of you are probably familiar with the Olmstead case. Some of you may not be as familiar. So let me spend just a few moments talking about the Olmstead. The Olmstead case was litigated by my colleague and mentor, and Sue has devoted her legal career as a legal service, but really being a voice for those who so often do not have a voice in our justice system, and particularly those in psychiatric hospitals. She started out in Florida and continued her work in the 1980s and would go in to the psychiatric hospitals, both in Florida and then right here in Atlanta, Georgia, and get to know the men and women who had been in the psychiatric hospitals. Many, especially when she was first, had been in the hospital for decades. She came to know a woman named Lois Curtis in the 1990s, had been in and out of Georgia Regional Hospital in Atlanta, which is, for those of you familiar with Atlanta, is just off of in 285, where I-20 East meets 285, just outside of Decatur. And Lois had been at Georgia Regional over 30 times, and it had essentially been a revolving door where she'd come in, she would get some supports, go back out in the community, and not very much longer would end up right back at Georgia Regional Hospital. Treatment team, her doctors, and the people
Callie,
working
I'm
with
I'm sorry
her
to
her.
Interrupt you. Could I get you to speak up a little bit louder?
Sure. Speaking with a Georgia Regional, all agreed that she was a community and that she would thrive in the community and was not doing nearly as well while she was at the hospital. And, Stu brought a case. It's a very rare case that ends up in the United States Supreme Court. But case under the Americans with Disabilities Act, there had been some good decisions, particularly some good work that Steve Gold had been doing in other parts of the country. The Americans with Disabilities Act at that time had was passed in 1991. This was happening between 1997 and 1999. And the legal theory was that under the Americans with Disabilities Act, Lois had the right to receive the supports that she needed in, rather than an institution, and that it was in fact segregation, discrimination, for her to be receiving those supports at Georgia Regional Hospital, to basically be locked up in the hospital in order to receive the supports she needed. The Supreme Court ruled in favor, and because it was the United States Supreme Court, the decision did not only affect Lois and Elaine, who had joined the case, but a decision that has had major ramifications and has begun the work of transforming our for people with disabilities across the country. The major finding of the court was that there is a qualified right to live and receive supports. As I said, Olmstead's based on the Americans with Disabilities Act, and at the very beginning of the Americans, if you have not read it, it is an important document, important to read. Congress made a number of discrimination, and what Congress said was that for most of our country's history, up through the time the ADA was passed, people with disabilities were being systematically discriminated against and segregated. The Congress made it very clear that it was, in fact, segregation to require people to receive the supports they needed in institutions rather than in the community. The Americans with Disabilities Act is not does not apply to everyone. It applies to people, qualified individuals with disabilities. And broadly, what the Americans with Disabilities Act does, and what it prohibits discrimination and requires reasonable accommodations and reasonable modifications in certain situations. The Olmstead case was based out of Title II Abilities Act. The Americans with Disabilities Act is separated by a number of different titles that involve different ways in which employers and different other bodies are required to provide reasonable accommodations to people with disabilities, to not discriminate against people with disabilities. Title II of the ADA covers public entities, that's state and local governments, and other agencies of government, and requires that a public entity not refuse to provide services to individuals who have a disability, who qualify as a qualified individual with a disability. And it also requires that services be in the most integrated setting appropriate to an individual's needs. And it also has the reasonable accommodation and reasonable requirement. Let me just take 1 second. We're going to come back to this a couple times in this session. But let me talk about the relationship between the reasonable accommodation requirement and the state non-obligation to fundamentally alter the way in which it provides services. If you picture a seesaw and you have on one side the requirement that a state provide a reasonable accommodation or a reasonable modification, there's a balance. It does not have to fundamentally alter. It does not have to completely transform the very essence of whatever service it's providing. And so would look at whether or not a state, when a state is being asked to make an accommodation for a qualified individual, whether or not the state is being asked really to fundamentally alter sort of the essence of what it is doing. And if it is moves over to the fundamental alteration side, then the state would not be, or the other public entity. The quick question for everyone, and I don't know, we're going to give you the answer, but you can figure it out before we get to the answer, and that is, what is the ADA integration regulation? Is it a federal regulation from the United States Justice Department requiring public entities to administer services, programs, and activities in the most appropriate setting? In the most integrated setting appropriate to the needs of the qualified individuals with disabilities? Is it a federal law that applies to schools that they teach students in the least restrictive environment? The Olmstead decision, or is it a requirement in the ADA that no children should receive disability services in the institution? Or is it all of the above? The answer, and this, the reason I asked this question is because it was at the core of the Olmstead, and that is the answer, we can get back to it, is that it's a federal regulation that the United States Justice Department had issued after the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, requiring public entities to administer service programs and activities in the most integrated setting appropriate to the needs of the qualified disabilities. And this integration regulation was sort of the core of the Olmstead decision. And court, while it looked at a lot of things, it really sort of focused in on this integration regulation and stated that if the state of Georgia provides services to Lois and Elaine in the community, it needed to do so, unless it was going to fundamentally provide services to everyone else. In order to look at not only Lois's and Elaine's situation, but all of that would arise in this context, the Supreme Court created a three-part test. And I've highlighted the third because the first two factors of this test have not been nearly as much in controversy. And one of the sort of common sense that it would be less in controversy than the third. So we'll focus in on the third, but let me just go through the three that the court says that a court or a state, an entity, needs to look at in determining whether it's required state-supported services in the most integrated setting under Olmstead. The first factor or criteria of the LS, when treatment, and it parts of the court decision, it says when state treatment professionals, but when treatment professionals determine that community placement is appropriate, that while the court mentioned in the case that it was state treatment professionals, subsequent courts have really said that that's given the context that Lois was being treated by state officials, and it doesn't have to be a state treatment professional who determines that community placement is appropriate, but really the whether or not the person is able to live in the community and able to receive supports in the community. And at this point, I think of us in the advocacy community believe that almost everyone, if not everyone, is able to live in the community are treatment professionals who will support that decision and who believe that's true. One of the issues that will pop up here, though, of course, is it the community that exists or is it the community that has to exist under the ADA? Because if the community and those supports don't exist in the community, then arguably a treatment professional may find, well, this person can't live in the community. But if those supports are made available, then they could live in the community. And that really should be if reasonable supports are provided. The second issue is when an individual does not oppose moving in the community, it's logical that if you've gotten to this point and you're actually in a court case, that a person's not going to sue the community if they oppose moving into the community. So once you get to court, this factor doesn't make as much sense action or some larger type of lawsuit that's involving lots of people, including those who aren't sort of actively. But courts have also made it clear that the opposed language, especially in a case called Messier, there's the court that it's not necessarily that a person actively asks to move into community. It's that they do not oppose moving into community. And is that a person will want to live in the community, the person can live in the community, the person should live in the community. And so it's only if we make it clear they don't want to live in the community, that they prefer living in the institution, that this factor should come into play. The issue and the real criterion that is the one that has sparked all of the subsequent litigation is when the placement innovation balanced with the needs of others. And this is that seesaw I referred to earlier between what's reasonable for the state to have to do versus what's going to fundamentally alter services. In looking at the fundamental alteration test, the Olmstead Court, this language that ultimately was the seed for Olmstead planning. It said, sensibly construed, the fundamental alteration defense would allow a state the allocation of available resources, immediate relief for the plaintiffs would be inequitable. Had a comprehensive, effective, working plan for placing qualified individuals, and in this case it was mental disabilities, but that until it's really been sort of erased in the Olmstead subsequent cases because it involved the Olmstead case applies to all people with disabilities. But if the state has a comprehensive, effective, working plan, it's restrictive settings, and it has a waiting list that moves at a reasonable pace, then a state may be able to argue that it does not to provide the relief immediately to the particular person. Now, there's a lot of, these are pretty loaded statements. The one that worries advocates the most, of course, is the waiting list that moves at a reasonable pace. But it's important to realize that there's a lot there before you get to the waiting list. First of all, the court was talking about immediate relief when the Olmstead decision came out, which was nine. Since 1999, every state in this nation has had the obligation, which really it had since the Americans with passed, but it was made clear to them in 1999 that they needed to have a comprehensive, effective working plan for providing people in the community rather than in institutions. And so if you take that word immediate seriously in the first, then what that means is that the states really had to have had these comprehensive, effective working plans in 99. And to the extent that waiting lists even come into play, they really needed to be moving at a reasonable pace for the last 13 years. And so I think that that waiting list term is much diminished by the fact that it only comes when you've considered the time factor states have had this obligation, and two, whether or not they have a comprehensive, effective working plan. And a little bit already, and as I'll get into much more detail, states really have not come up with comprehensive, effective working plans. Or this obligation or this defense that a state has to not serve people right away if they have the comprehensive, effective working plan really shouldn't play much of a factor because they don't have such a plan. Now, courts have explained a little bit more about the fundamental alteration defense, and one of the courts have looked specifically at what makes up a Olmstead plan, and also what or defenses states can raise if they want to raise the fundamental alteration defense. First of all, two courts widely cited, both the Third Circuit, which is up where Pennsylvania is, the Tenth Circuit, where Oklahoma is, have said that budgetary constraints alone give the state a fundamental alteration defense. And the Fisher decision, I think, has especially been the last few years because the Olmstead litigation has really heated up during this time. We were also in a time of pretty serious constraints throughout our 50 states. And the Fisher Court essentially said that bad economic times are not going to be a defense for a state to uphold its people in the most integrated setting. And it's important to realize that the burden is on the state and not on bringing the litigation when it comes to whether or not the fundamental alteration defense is going to win the case for the state. So what is an Olmstead plan? As we discussed, the main terminology when an Olmstead plan is discussed comes from that part of the decision, which was really a plurality section of the Olmstead that's been so widely cited as I think there's few who would dispute that that's a core element of the Olmstead decision. But the term comes from that section, and at a minimum, Olmstead plan needs to be comprehensive, needs to be effective, it needs to be working, and the way I read that term working means that it has to be in effect, and things actually have to be coming into play. There's a decision of the Circuit Court of the District of Columbia just last month, Edward Day versus the District of Columbia. I encourage you, if you haven't gotten a chance, decision, it's that 2012 U.S. District Lexus 18213 is the citation I have, but court looked at Olmstead planning and that the District of Columbia was saying that it had done and essentially said what the state is trying to put forward as an Olmstead plan at least does not pass the muster of being such a legal plan that the case needs to be thrown out. They didn't get into, the court did not get into whether or not for sure the plan was or was not. It essentially looked at what the state was putting forward as things that it had done to try to comply with Olmstead, and the court said as a matter of law that's not necessarily enough and that they're going to need to move with the litigation. So I encourage you, if you're looking at some litigation right now, to look at that case, because that's I believe the most case or the most recent case looking at Olmstead planning. So some earlier cases out of Pennsylvania got into what an Olmsted plan is. The two cases were Frederick 1 and Frederick 2. It was basically the same case, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, on two different occasions. At first, the Frederick Court really was deferring to the state of Pennsylvania and saying, Pennsylvania, you know what's your, and you can come up with the plan to serve these individuals in the most integrated setting. But what your plan really needs to have, and use sort of squishy language, is a commitment to action in a manner for which it can then be held accountable by the courts. Well, the state of Pennsylvania went back and basically did not put forward much of a plan. So the case bounced back up to the appellate court, and the court said, okay, that what you've provided is basically a vague assurance that you're going to do what your required decision, and that's simply not enough. At a bare minimum, the state has an obligation to specify the time frame for when people are going to get out of the institution, the number of people who are going to leave the institution, and the option of community coordination services necessary. This is still not a very clear mandate, and one of the things that happens once it gets to the court level is that courts to voice their will on a state, they courts will often, and this happened after Brown v. Board of Education, it's happened in the Olmsted cases, courts really want to rely on the states to come up with their own plan for how they're going to transform their system. It's the states who understand what the resources are, how to get the resources. It's the states working with the advocacy community that courts believe need to be in conversation in terms of what are the needs, what are the supports necessary. It's states that have all of the data. But if states don't live up to their obligation, will step in and try to force the states to do so. What that has meant, and my colleague Charlie Bliss and I wrote a paper on comparing Olmsted to the time after Brown v. Board of Education, is that because states have still a responsibility to conform with the Olmsted integration mandate, that they have not so far, for the most part, lived up to all, and courts have taken different, when a case is brought, the court will look at the particular specific population that's at issue, will ultimately try to enforce the Olmsted decision. Almost all of the cases go in favor of the people bringing the litigation, but we'll again try to turn it back to the state and the parties to work out some sort of settlement agreement or some sort of plan form with it. There are a number of experts who testify in many of these litigation cases that suggest specific parameters, but so far it's still mostly the case that the courts are deferring back to the parties to do what they're obligated to do. And our comparison with Brown v. Board of Education is that that's what for the first 10 to 15 years after Brown v. Board of Education, but states really did not move as much as they needed to during that time, and counties and school systems did not move. And it was only when the courts became much more involved and much more that reform happened immediately, rather than just relying on states to come up with plans or school systems to come up with plans, that change happened. And it was also when the Justice Department got involved. And that's one of the things that's happening today, is that the Justice Department has taken a much more proactive stance on getting the states to conform with their obligations under Olmsted. So who does Olmsted apply to? As we said earlier, the sort of legal terminology for the ADA is a qualified person, individual with a disability, but for Olmstead to apply, it really applies to people who are either in institutions or who are at risk of institutionalization. The risk of institutionalization criteria became crystallized in this Fisher case. There were a number of people who said they'd rather die than go into a nursing home. And the state of Oklahoma said, well, Olmstead doesn't apply to them because they'd rather die than be in an institution. So they're not in an institution. And the court said, no, the integration regulation applies to people both who are in institutions and those who are at substantial risk of being in an institution. It also has been applied in various areas where people receive disability supports. There's a couple cases out of California involving a day treatment program and lessening personal supports. The Oklahoma case was actually about the amount of medication people receive. And then there's a really important case that we're all just waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to see what happens to in New York called the DAI case versus, it was Patterson now, versus Cuomo, which involved large state-funded but privately run institution-like group homes. And that case really is sort of the next step in Olmstead, but these group homes are so much like institutions, it's hard to see how a court will not find that the integration mandate applies to these homes. But that case is on appeal to the Second Circuit of New York, and the last time I checked, which was just a couple of weeks ago, I had not seen that a decision had been issued in that case. And again, I had mentioned the Messier case earlier. States may have an obligation to actually go assess individuals to see who is eligible for community supports. A state may not just, at least according to this court, rests on just waiting for people to actually raise their hands and say they want to live in the community, because the standard is whether they oppose living in the community as opposed to whether they necessarily volunteer to move into the community. In Georgia, we have gone through a pretty extensive effort to create an Olmstead plan. And sadly, we have still not gotten there. Next month, we will have another series of extensive Olmstead planning meetings. And this has been both a positive and an extremely frustrating experience for the Olmstead advocates in the state of Georgia. I think it's also been frustrating for a lot of the people in the state of Georgia government, but I wanted to talk a little bit about what we've been doing, because I think that just our own efforts here in Georgia can also give a window into what's likely happening throughout the states. Although if you go to the PATH Center website out of California, they've got a list of, they try to keep updated on all of the different Olmstead plans and Olmstead planning efforts of all the 50 states, and where it's happening, where it's not happening. You can see where the different states are, but I have yet to really come across a state that has a fully developed, working, effective Olmstead plan. But there's a lot of efforts going on out there. New Jersey's is probably the one that I've seen that's, that comes closest to having what I think are some of the essential elements of a plan. And then what Georgia has done, I think, has really moved the ball forward. It just hasn't been adopted by the state. So because Georgia was the home of the Olmstead case, there was a lot of effort after the Olmstead decision to do serious Olmstead planning, come up with a plan to implement the Supreme Court's decision. And that effort took place mostly in the advocacy community, although the state had a number of blue ribbon commissions to look into what it would take to have an Olmstead plan. And ultimately, each of those attempts ended up with no plan coming into effect. I think when we, in our most recent efforts, we came across four different planning documents that were never adopted, where state officials and advocates came together to try to come up with a working plan. that began the change in 2009 when the state of Georgia entered into a settlement agreement with the United States Department of Health and Human Services, specifically the Office for Civil Rights for Health and Human Services. The state promised at that time in a settlement agreement that it would once again undertake a comprehensive Olmstead planning process. The settlement agreement laid out very specific things that would need to be in the Olmstead plan. It laid out who were the main individuals that would be involved in the Olmstead plan. One of the problems with the settlement agreement was it did not involve people in nursing homes. And of course, as we know, that is a huge part of the population that is covered by Olmstead, but the Department of Health and Human Services decided in their settlement negotiations to give up the nursing home populations and focus it in on people with mental illness and people with developmental disabilities in the state of Georgia. Fortunately, once we got into the Olmstead planning process, even though it wasn't mandated by the settlement agreement, all of the people at the table recognized that all people who are covered by Olmstead had to be part of the state's Olmstead planning process. The planning process went from 2009 up through today. The first 2 years, we had two different Olmstead coordinators who were not based in the state of Georgia. And I think that was a drawback. I mean, it's always good to have expertise from around the country, but when you're getting down to the nitty-gritty of how you're changing the institutions in the state, I think it's important to have somebody who's here on the ground and who's going to be here on the ground for the long term to help with the planning process. Ultimately, we got an Olmstead coordinator named Bill James, who was our third. We're now in our fourth, but Bill James came out of Florida, where he had been assistant commissioner of their department for people with disabilities. He had extensive experience in what was necessary, particularly for people with mental illness in the community. But most importantly, he was a former lieutenant colonel in the Army. And Bill's perspective was that if this was going to be an effective plan, you needed to have very clear goals or objectives, and you had to have very clear steps how you were going to get there. You needed a timeline, you needed data, you needed all of the supports necessary, and you needed cost models for how much all of this is going to cost. And I, from what I've seen of all of the different Olmstead plans across the country, I think all of those aspects are what are missing. And there's a lot of the Olmstead plans, very general language about rights and the importance of living in the community, but in terms of the economics, in terms of the schedule, in terms of how you're actually going to make it happen, that's what is often missing. I think we had an advantage that didn't exactly work out in our favor here because there was a settlement agreement to back it up. Unfortunately, the settlement agreement did not have very strict enforcement provisions that we could really sort of hold Georgia's feet to the fire. That being said, we got everybody at the table in this Olmstead planning. And the Olmstead planning included our state Medicaid agency, which here in Georgia is the Georgia Department of Community Health. We had the newly developed Georgia Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities. We had mental health advocates. We had physical disability advocates. We had self-advocates. We had people who were advocates in different areas. We had the providers. We had all of the interested parties at the table. And probably most important, we had an individual named Jason Bearden, who was in the governor's office of planning and budget, who could run the numbers and create different budget economic models about what it would cost to actually implement the different aspects that we were included. Now, I see a question about the actual Olmstead plan. I can share. I'm not sure that the most recent one is actually up on the state's website. There's an older one on the state's website that was not as, it wasn't very good. But there's a more recent one that was sent to our governor in 2010 that I can share with everyone. And that's the sort of the framework piece that we're using now as we once again continue our discussions on the Olmstead planning or our Olmstead plan. What was going on in Georgia at the same time, and part of the reason for my titling this this webinar on litigation and collaboration is that we had litigation going on at the same time. So while we were very much collaborating and working together based on this earlier settlement, there was a major litigation going on between the United States Justice Department and the state of Georgia on Olmstead. And that litigation arose out of some very serious incidents of abuse, neglect, and deaths in our state psychiatric hospitals. The Justice Department did an extensive series of investigations and sent our governor, our former governor, Governor Sonny Perdue, a couple 50-page letters listing out all of the issues and saying that the state had to fix that. We'll get to my elements of an essential plan in a second. But while one of the things that happened in that Justice Department litigation was that in January of 2010, January 2009, just about 3 days before President Obama entered office, the Obama administration, I'm sorry, the Bush administration's Justice Department entered into a settlement agreement with the state of Georgia. And I do not know whether that was a political decision or whether that was simply a decision to end litigation that they had ongoing prior to leaving office. But whatever the reason was, the result was that the settlement agreement had two fundamental glaring problems. And the first was that it did not involve Olmstead. It just involved the state hospital, what happened inside the state hospital. And for all of us who are major Olmstead advocates and believed that the services really needed to be in the community, this settlement agreement was actually going to be counterproductive because it was going to require the state to make the hospital safer by pouring a ton of money into the hospitals, and of course sucking the money out of the community was what we all believed would happen. Second, there weren't very strong enforcement provisions in the settlement agreement. We all raised a lot of complaints, but fortunately a non-lawyer, because we lawyers thought that there was a settlement. You had basically an agreement between the state of Georgia and the Justice Department. You had to follow that. Fortunately, a non-lawyer wrote the judge, and the judge refused, based on this non-lawyer's letter, and because she had been a long-time advocate and actually had done some advocacy within the Bush, the first Bush administration on mental health, the judge listened to her and basically forced the state of Georgia and the Justice Department to sit down with the advocates in the state of Georgia to come up with a different solution to our issue. The Obama administration came in, and the Obama Justice Department really pretty quickly made civil rights, for the Civil Rights Division, made Olmstead a priority. And ultimately, while we were doing all of this Olmstead planning, the Justice Department and the state of Georgia were once again litigating their issues, but with Olmstead a much bigger focus. And many of the solutions and the plans and goals, objectives, and steps to get there that we put in our Olmstead plan, certainly not all of them, but many of them ended up in the settlement agreement. The problem with the settlement agreement and the settlement agreement between the state of Georgia and the Justice Department was in October 2010. The problem with settlement that everyone will tell you is you don't get nearly as much as you're asking for, but you get a lot more than you would get if you lost. I think the Georgia settlement agreement is strong for people with mental illness, it's pretty weak for people with developmental disabilities, particularly for those people with developmental disabilities living in the community. I think the Justice Department learned some things. The recent settlement agreement that was announced in the state of Virginia, I'm not very familiar with it, but it sounds much, much stronger for people with developmental disabilities. But the settlement agreement ultimately did incorporate some of the Olmstead planning we did here in Georgia. And so even though we don't have a set Olmstead plan, many of the things that we did sort of together working collaboratively ended up in that settlement agreement and are now enforceable by the Justice Department and the court. From all of that experience, I came up with sort of my essential elements of what needs to be in an Olmstead plan, and frankly, I just don't see this in Olmstead plans that I've looked at across the country. First of all, you need a strong leader. I think for us, having Bill James there, and he was out of the governor's office, he had the ear, not necessarily of the governor, but the governor's chief of staff and a number of people in the Georgia governor's office, really made a difference. It all called people. He was calling from the governor's office. People picked up the phone. People came to meetings. And then he also had a very clear eye for where our Olmstead planning needed to go. Second, one of our real deficiencies in Georgia and where for good Olmstead planning there needs to be a huge emphasis is on quality data and comprehensive understanding of need. You have to know how many people need the supports, what supports are needed, in order to make a really comprehensive, effective working plan. Third, you not only need a strong leader of that actual committee, but you need a commitment from state leaders, providers, and the advocacy community. Again, because the Justice Department was here, that made a big difference in getting that commitment. But I also believe pretty strongly that a number of our state leaders really decided that this was the right thing to do, and that education efforts around the importance of integration really did sink through for a number of our leaders, and having everyone believe in this and be committed to it makes a difference. We at our Olmstead Planning Committee meetings have had throughout, we've had the leadership from our housing department that covers most of the state, not the city of Atlanta, which is, of course, the main gorilla in the state of Georgia, but most of the rest of the state. We have a department that covers subsidized housing. They've been at the table. We've had our Medicaid agency at the table bringing data. They've brought a lot of data to these meetings. We've had our new agency, which is our Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities, really running, sort of being the working part of the committee. And then we've had a strong commitment from the provider community, and we've had self-advocates, and we've basically gotten all of the leading advocates in the developmental disability community and the physical disability community and the mental health community at the table. And so I think that that's the only way we can do it. And then we also made a commitment to have working committees so that not all of the work was going to happen in the large monthly committee meetings, but that we would have working group specifically look at physical disabilities, working group specifically look at issues around mental health. Those working groups did a really good job of discussing the main issues, coming up with clear goals. They were never able to pull out of our system, partly because the system just hasn't ever been able to do it, the data that we really needed. And I think that's a real sort of weakness of where we've come from here in Georgia. Finally, especially in mental health, I think it's as important as anywhere, but you need expert knowledge of the supports needed for the population. There's a big difference in planning for people with mental illness than for people with developmental disabilities and physical disabilities, at least in this state, but I expect that's true across the country because there's not Medicaid waivers for people with mental illness like there are. Now, people will say that, yes, there are, that you can do a 1915I or you can do other sort of quasi-waivers, and now there's even a newer way to bring, or at least there's been a NOFA, federal regulators have said that we can move in this direction of having a comprehensive waiver that crosses over disability groups. But those simply have not existed in the past, and therefore what you have is you have two different kinds of systems. In the physical disability and the developmental disability arenas, you have systems of haves and have-nots, because if you have a Medicaid waiver, you usually are able, especially if it's funded well enough, to get the supports you need. And of course, the providers come and provide services if the money's there in the community. On the mental health side, because of historically Congress has been very reluctant to allow a waiver for mental health because Medicaid had not been paying for the mental health services in the institutions, you don't have that same system, and you have a much more first of all, it's a system that's in Georgia, and I expect around the country, not well funded, but you also have just a myriad of providers and services. And in some ways, that also reflects just the different needs of people with mental illness and substance abuse issues, because people are on different parts of their road to recovery. Recovery is, of course, a huge aspect of having a mental health disability or an addictive disease. And so because you have people in different places, the supports are also going to be just different. And so I believe strongly that we have not gotten a perfect answer for all of the supports needed for anyone, but particularly in the mental health and addictive disease arena. And so in Georgia, we've got a lot of supports. I encourage you to go, if you Google Georgia Justice Department settlement, you'll come across the website where I put up everything that has to do with the Georgia Justice Department settlement. And you can look at our settlement, you can look at all the services, particularly in the mental health arena. And I think we did well with imperfect information, but I think that we can constantly be including the community, particularly people with lived experience of mental illness, the providers, the experts, everybody, in really developing what the system needs to be. One place where we really do shine in Georgia, and what is a huge part of our Olmstead plan and the settlement, is peer support. And I think having peer support in all of these areas is essential. The disability community has a saying, nothing about us without us. It is so essential to include people with disabilities in all of this work and planning. You also need somebody who understands money. We often fall behind in our planning. It's having somebody who understands how states create budgets, how they cost things out. And it was really, I think the Justice Department settlement here in Georgia happened in part because a lot of the things that we suggested in the Olmstead plan was costed out. You need specialists on maximizing funding from HUD, from Medicare and Medicaid, and from state funds. You also need great models. For us, Pathways to Housing in New York, which is also in Washington and Philadelphia and I think Vermont, was a model for what we were looking for a best practice for mental health supports for people with severe and persistent mental illness, to live in the community. And we looked at how Pathways to Housing was doing things, and they had one of their main advocacy points is housing first, and that you have to have funding for housing for the system for there to be really systemic change where you don't have people going in and out of institutions but living in the community. And what we figured out on a trip with state leaders as well as advocates was that the state of New York was paying for some of the housing. And because of that, you don't necessarily have, and they certainly aren't paying for enough in New York, but that because there was state funds, you have all of the same regulations that come with Section 8 housing or shelter plus care housing. And so that was probably the key aspect of the order in Georgia, was to have 2,000 units of housing that the state of Georgia would pay for as it changed from a institution-based system for people with mental illness to a community-based system. And I think that was probably as critical a part. Then we had our Office of Planning and Budget as well as the department actually cost it out and figure out how much is it going to cost to provide this housing. And then that ended up being a key piece of the Justice Department settlement agreement. And I really think it was when the state of Georgia, and I think they would say this, when the state of Georgia actually saw the costs, even though they were significant, and we were in a terrible recession, they were able to come to a settlement because the money was actually listed out. As I said, we have a lot of services on the mental health side, less on the DD side, and there may be some who, and I was not at the table in the negotiations, but I think there would be, some could legitimately say that we got sort of a lot of what we needed, whether or not it's carried out now is another question, but what we needed in the settlement on the mental health side, but not as much in the DD side, and that's something that also needs to really be done thoughtfully, is making sure that the plan is comprehensive and covers all people with disabilities. The Olmstead planning has to have a commitment to integration, and I'm not going to get into the debate right here about exactly what integration means. But it's very important to have a very honest, open discussion about integration, but also to make sure that voices are at the table who really believe strongly in what it means to be fully integrated as a person with disability. And that needs to come from the disability community. I mean, I would suggest ADAPT be a really strong voice, or people who are involved with ADAPT, but there needs to be a strong voice of what integration means for people with disabilities at the table. The plan needs to be both ambitious and realistic, and I much prefer the term ambitious because there's so much change that needs to happen, but the goals have to be attainable, and there has to be measurable outcomes, there has to be a quality improvement mechanism, and there has to be a consequence if the goals are not achieved, if the state doesn't do what it says it's going to do. And that's difficult, again, without litigation, which is why I sort of believe in this hybrid approach of both litigation and collaboration. Now, for the lawyers who are listening, I know that's easier said than done, given our ethical requirements, but at least in the state of Georgia, we have some of those ethical requirements are, you also have a right to seek redress from the government, which our ethics rules take and ethics opinions take into account, and you certainly have the right to be in conversation with the government about these issues. But you have to be careful. I spent a lot of time calling the bar and making sure that I was on the right line of our ethics rules while all of this was going on, because it was so important, but it was so important to be in conversation. And I was in some ways fortunate not to be a litigator in the Georgia Justice Department litigation, so that I could also still be working with the policymakers. Concrete tools for implementing Olmstead. And this is where we begin to move into what are some of the things that both have come out of Olmstead but also led up to Olmstead. Increased housing. The District of Columbia case, which I've mentioned earlier, that just came out in February, talks a little bit about this. Housing is at the core of a successful Olmstead plan. At the same time, states will have my legitimate arguments that housing is not what they provide through Medicaid And if this is really about sort of changing medical services, then why should they have to involve housing? The reality is that it's the only way for it to work. And if you don't have significant integrated, accessible housing, you're never going to fully implement Olmstead. So there needs to be ways in which you involve everyone in all programs in increasing housing. One of the great things that is still developing but is coming out of our Justice Department settlement is that our Department of Community Affairs, which as I said does a lot of the subsidized housing in this state, has gotten technical assistance collaborative, a technical assistance group on housing, to work with them, to work with HUD to increase the amount of housing. We've just gotten a relaxation of one of the HUD rules to make sure that people who are getting out of institutions, including nursing homes, can get a priority for Section 8 housing. The Obama administration and Congress have changed around, and HUD have changed around Section 811. There's a lot of new opportunities for housing through Section 811, particularly if that gets appropriated right. It's also important to understand some of the requirements of things like Shelter Plus Care. Shelter Plus Care is a lot of the housing inside Atlanta that's under permanent supportive housing. It's related to the McKinney-Vento Homeless Act. And that's housing for people who have disabilities, who are homeless. And one of the issues we found with Shelter Plus Care here in Georgia was that housing was actually not available for people in our state psychiatric hospitals, even if they went in homeless, because there was a 30-day requirement that once you had been in the hospital for 30 days, you no longer were homeless. You had a home. It was the psychiatric hospital. And, of course, that's ridiculous. My understanding is HUD's changed that to 90 days now. But you definitely have to understand all of the housing rules and increase housing. Medicaid waivers. Again, Medicaid waivers, I think, are 90% positive, but one of the main issues with Medicaid waivers is it does create a system of haves and have-nots, and to the extent waiting lists continue to be allowed, which arguably under Olmstead you have some arguments that we need to get rid of some of the waiting lists, but there was a case early on out of Hawaii that makes that somewhat difficult. But the Medicaid waivers have got to be a key tool for landing. Money follows the person is an essential element of for a lot of states. I encourage you, if you haven't learned about money follows the person, to learn about it. And if your state doesn't have it, get your state to get it, because money follows the person is basically a transition program for people out of nursing homes. It provides bridge funding, so people who have been in nursing homes for a long period of time can still get the supports, or can basically get reconnected to the community. So it'll pay for security deposits. It'll pay for making a home accessible. It will pay for moving costs, all the things that are necessary to move a person back out in the community. Supported employment, peer supports, assistive technology. I'm going to hurry up a little bit since we had a little technical issues earlier. But environmental control, home modifications, all of these things are essential to good Olmstead planning and Olmstead integration. So some of the technology that can support it. Homestead integration, as I say, include environmental controls, home modifications, health sensors, and any assistive technology that will help a person live in the community. So I've got three of them here. It looks like I've sort of given you the answer, but I've got a question for you, and that is, select the three assistive technologies that are most appropriate to assist a person to return to the community. It's somewhat of a trick question because number C, communication devices certainly can be, but not if they're used in a skilled facility or a hospital. And the bladder catheter supplies are not actually assistive technology, but certainly those can also help individuals living in the community. The future of Olmstead, where are we going? Another website that I encourage you to visit is the United States Department of Justice's Olmstead homepage. They've really done a good job of describing all of the places in which the Justice Department is working to further Olmstead, but they also include a number of the technical assistance guides. It's a great place to go to get both a better handle on Olmstead, but also to see what's happening in the individual states with respect to Olmstead. The federal government is providing more and more tools and working. I continue to hear that HUD is working as closely as they ever have to work together for housing and medical issues. And so Money Follows the Person is a tool that's been around for a while, but it's increasing. The Balancing the Incentives Program, Georgia is qualified because we have less than 50% of our funds going to having people outside in the community. And so we are getting, through the Affordable Care Act, extra money to serve people in the community. And if your state qualifies, you should definitely get your state to get that free money. We continue need to educate people. As I say, I think one of the big changes that has happened in Georgia, we have a long way to go, but we've begun to really get leadership that understands Olmstead, that believes in Olmstead, and that makes a huge difference. Peer support, involvement, and then also celebrating successes. We celebrate when people move into the community. Some of our local self-advocate have a welcome home gathering every month to welcome people who have left nursing homes and back in the community and connecting them in the community and getting their stories out. We're in the paper a lot down here in Atlanta talking about Olmstead. We try to have big newspaper articles every month about what's going on. Illinois has had some huge successes, and I encourage you to look at what has happened in Illinois and their Olmstead litigation. That's the great first step. Now it's important for the state of Illinois and every other state that's doing this to celebrate what's happening to people once they're back in the community and to get the stories out about how it really is better living in the community. Challenges going forward. One of the big challenges we're facing here in Georgia is that our Medicaid is wanting to move all of our ABD Medicaid, which is aging, blind, and disabled people with disabilities, but ABD Medicaid to managed care. And so we have raised, and you'll see if you go to our Georgia Justice Department website, that I've got a letter in there that I've sent just in the last month to our governor and to our commissioners and to the Justice Department and our court monitor saying managed care while the Justice Department settlement is happening, because what they're proposing doing is moving all of our mental health services into managed care right in the middle of this settlement agreement. And that, I think, has lots of problems. Now, we do hear stories. In Georgia, we tend to hear them about Texas and Tennessee, that there have been some successes for Olmstead because there's a financial incentive, at least for some people, to receive supports in the community rather than institutions. But this is a big issue. Steve Gold has sent out, if you just Google Steve Gold, he sent out some pointers on what advocates and what states should be looking at with respect to its populations with institution-level disabilities, what they should be looking at when they're considering moving into managed care, particularly with Medicaid. Another big challenge going forward, as I've mentioned, is the Medicaid waivers still having waiting lists. While that is what the federal law allows for Medicaid waivers, there is an issue that this may contradict Olmstead. And if the state is still under an obligation to have a comprehensive, effective working plan, and we're 12 years into it, there's a pretty good to start moving away from waiting lists and into everybody receiving the supports in the community. There's also going to be an issue if an individual is not really receiving state-funded supports but living with aging parents, whether or not Olmstead applies. We certainly think it does. I have not seen any cases that have really sort of hit that point. And there's also not full consensus on what exactly is needed in a state or a community. And so we all have to be part of that conversation. I think, as I've mentioned before, integration has to be the most important aspect of that. But for me, employment also for those who want and are able to work, and if that includes supports or customizable employment, employment needs to be a huge part of that conversation, as well as housing. The systems continue to lack funds. There's a lack of quality providers and are not completely dependent on each other, but they are very related, the lack of funds and the lack of quality providers. There's a lack of sufficient professional training in certain areas. That's something here in Georgia. And then, the once again, nothing without us, nothing about us without us, is a huge and important statement that people with disabilities make, especially in the advocacy community. And people with disabilities included in the decision-making, planning, and providing of services. I just wrote out a quick final thought. You can read it, but Olmstead, it's an exciting time. It's unfortunately, it's gotten far enough in our journey, but this is a fight worth having. It's a process worth moving forward and informing our communities to really make them integrated for everybody, to really live out the American dream for all of our people. And it's something that I hope all of you are excited to be a part of, because it's a great thing. And so I'll now open it up with the last 13 minutes for any questions.
Thanks, Tally.
Marissa, if you've seen some, yeah.
Thank you so much, and thank you for everyone, and Tally and everybody for sticking with us today. I know we had some sound issues. So let's get right to the questions. Let's see here. Could you, what kind of enforcement provisions are usually found in DOJ Olmstead settlement agreements? Have these enforcement measures been used against any states?
That's a great question. I'm mostly familiar with the Georgia one. There's a number of settlements that are in on the DOJ Olmstead website, so I'm going to have to defer a little bit to what those settlement agreements state. But let me talk about what we had a real difference between the first settlement agreement and the second settlement agreement, and but also what our experience has been. In Georgia, the second settlement agreement made very clear that we would have an individual who would be intimately involved in the settlement agreement, that she would be coming to Georgia on a very regular basis. She's not from the state of Georgia, but she's somebody that both sides, strong expert in the field. Her name's Elizabeth Jones, and she's done really, really good work so far of getting to know all of the players, seeing all of the services as they're rolled out, but most importantly, meeting the people who are receiving the supports both prior to their receipt of the people who need the supports and the institutions, and then meeting them again outside in the community. And she has not just relied on her own expertise, but she's hired an expert in ACT services, an expert in DD services, to work with her in writing the reports to the court. The settlement agreement is pretty explicit that if the state doesn't follow the agreement, that department has the ability to essentially go back to the court and either make them do it or continue the litigation. And so far, at least, that those enforcement mechanisms, and the biggest ones being having the independent monitor and have the independent monitor make these reports and have the court keep the case open to enforce it, have made it a significant difference. So far, we're in the most critical year. And so it's sort of a tune-in answer as well, because Elizabeth Jones's report in August of 2012 is what everybody, the state, the advocacy community,
and Elizabeth herself are waiting for, because her first report was only 3 months into the settlement agreement, whereas the states had an overly start to implement this. And Ms. Jones gets to see a lot that many of us in the advocacy community don't get to see because of HIPAA, because of the state's the state's sort of letting us see everything that's going on. And so since she gets to meet everybody and see a lot of the people, as well as get her other experts to do that, that's going to be a really critical, if this is a success or not. We also have a quality improvement mechanism and reporting that's supposed to be going on as to the quality that is just rolling out. The state's actually behind schedule on that, but that's a piece that's important for on the transparency side a little bit more than on the enforcement side.
Okay, thanks, Tally. Next question is, in the DAI case, what is a large group home?
Large. It's been a little while since I've looked at the case, but as I remember, people in each home, so they were huge. I mean, they sounded a lot more like an institution than a home to me. Now, that's not to say the Olmstead doesn't apply to much smaller group homes. That's just sort of what that particular case was limited to.
Okay. Next question. Can you give an example of what would constitute a fundamental alteration for a state?
I don't think there is one. I speak as an advocate, so I would certainly recommend people get a second opinion, because I'm admittedly very biased. But in my opinion, there certainly can be times where if costs are just, and if the cost is all going to go to one person and sort of soak up the cost from everyone else, that would possibly be a fundamental alteration. But the reality is that the courts have really sort of moved more and more towards saying that an Olmstead plan has to be in place for the state to raise a fundamental alteration defense. And because really any state that has a full, comprehensive, effective, working Olmstead plan, it's going to be difficult. Now, that's not to say that some courts won't find in some places that there's a fundamental alteration, but I think it's becoming more and more difficult for states to make that argument.
Okay. Next question
I'm not going to give away anything more in terms of... Go ahead.
Okay. Next question is on nursing home or institution home transit waivers. Can they be used for all types of disabilities?
I am not familiar with a nursing home transit waiver. Is that from a particular state, do we know? What I am familiar is, I can again speak in Georgia. We have Money Follows the Person, which is the bridge funding then paired up with waivers. And for now, those waivers are, what the state did was it committed to the federal government that it would move out transition a certain number of people from nursing homes into each of the different state Medicaid waivers that we have, except it really didn't include the people developmental disabilities into our developmental disability waiver, which is a fight we're having right now. But we have three main Medicaid waivers for people, and those three from Money Follows the Person. And they're basically guaranteed a slot if they're in a nursing home, based on what the state of Georgia agreed to with the federal government, except the state finds that the individual is not eligible for the waiver. But if the individual is found eligible, they get it. But unfortunately, I'm not familiar with the nursing home transit waiver. I want to.
Okay, they actually clarified it would be for New York State.
Oh, okay. I'm going to research it. So my answer is I'm not familiar with it. And I'll look it up.
Okay. Next question. Does the obligation for planning under Olmstead require a statewide plan and deinstitutionalization plans for each individual? Can you clarify?
Right. It's not clear. I wish I could clarify. We get the Olmstead planning comes out of the language in the Olmstead decision that it's sort of the state doesn't have much of a defense if it does have a comprehensive, effective working plan with reasonably paced moving waiting lists. And so I would say that the term comprehensive is probably important in terms of how much it affects individuals. And every individual also has the right under the integration mandate, the integration regulation, the Olmstead decision, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Rehabilitation Act, receive supports in the community. And so the state, there's no absolute obligation that the state make an individual person, but at the same time, the less comprehensive it is, the less the state has the defense.
Okay.
And so the more comprehensive it is, the better it is.
Okay. On Medicaid waivers waiting lists, do you have an idea or know if there is a general cap on the amount of time those waiting lists can span?
I have not seen a case that specifically says, again, I would go to let me answer that in a couple. There's a case, I think it's Haddad, H-A-D-A-D, out of Florida, that can be somewhat helpful on that. And essentially in the Haddad case, I'll look it up while we're talking, but the court found that it was taking too long and didn't have an effective working or a reasonably paced moving waiting list and an effective plan. And so, that is an example of not sort of moving people out quickly enough. And I think that what's happened in some of the Illinois litigation and some of the Florida litigation, and I think there's a case in Tennessee, is that oftentimes these cases settle so you don't get the great decision that makes it absolutely crystal clear what a state is required to do. But I think pretty good idea of what a reasonably paced waiting list would be, and for somebody to be stuck in a nursing home or an institution for more than, I would say, give an exact amount. For me, it would be even just a couple of months, but anything that gets into a year or longer, I think is absolutely unacceptable and not a reasonably paced moving waiting list. That's not to say that it's not happening throughout the country, but I think when those cases are challenged, there's a pretty good chance. Certainly out of Alabama, it's called Boyd, which is sort of an outlier and does not have a good decision. But I personally just think that decision is wrong.
Okay. Well, we're at the end of our time at this time, so I just want to thank Telly for the presentation. It was a great session, and we had lots of questions. Marissa, you want to give any final comments?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can hear you.
Sorry. Sorry there. Definitely. We want to thank everybody for joining us today. Again, our apologies for the technical issues. We do have Tally's contact information, so we'll be happy to share that for any of those questions that we did not get to today. Again, we want to thank Tally for joining us today and sharing his time and his knowledge. Quick reminder that today's session was recorded and it will be available for viewing within 24 hours at www.adaconferences.org/resna/archives. We do invite you to join us for upcoming scheduled sessions, and you can, of course, find out from more about those at adaconferences.org. Lastly, this webinar is sponsored by the National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation and Research, NIDR, who funds your hosts for today's program, the Great Lakes, the Southwest ADA Centers, and the Resna Catalyst Project. We would like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed today are those of the presenters, and therefore no endorsement of the sponsoring agency should be inferred. Participants were asked to participate in a pre- and post-test for this session, so you will receive a link to the post-session via email at the conclusion of today's program. So we definitely encourage you to participate in our efforts, as well as helping us identify future topics. Again, thank you so much, Tally, and thank you to everyone for sticking with us today. We hope you have a great day. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you, everyone. I just want to point one more thing. The ADA centers have a case law website that's searchable, and it's a good tool that provides information to significant rulings under employment, local state government, and different titles, 1, 2, and 3 of the ADA. So I encourage you to take a look at that site. That's adacaselaw.org. And that will be a useful tool to reference some of the cases that Tally was mentioning today. So with that, we conclude this session. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Marissa. To exit, please click on the X at the upper right-hand corner. Have a good day.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.